Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, I have a wonderful guest to share with you. He is so inspiring. I've gotten to know him through the podcast, and he has so much to share. He's accomplished a lot. We haven't done a patient journey story in a few weeks, and I am excited for you all to hear all that he's accomplished, his diagnostic journey, and all these cool things that he has been able to do. So, Matthew Check, please tell us a little bit about yourself. I'm so happy to have you.
Glad to be here. Yeah, so my name is Matthew. I'm 21, and I have mitochondrial disorder.
Tell us about life. I think this started for you at a very, very young age, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So yes. Tell us about your diagnostic journey and like just what life was like for you as a baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was born in 2004. I am the youngest of three boys. I have two older brothers. I was born completely healthy and normal. I met all of my six-month checkup milestones, like weight and what do you call it when you sit up, like your exercises, your capabilities.
Milestones,
uh-huh. Yeah. But then at my one-year checkup, I completely plateaued. Like all growth stopped. I only weighed 19 pounds at my 1 year. And this is when I just completely stopped gaining weight. And my parents actually noticed a lot of abdominal bloating and constipation. My stomach would get so distended. They used to say it looked like I was pregnant because it was just so distended and
wow.
Full of gas. And all the physical milestones were delayed. I didn't walk until I was about 19 and a half months old.
Okay.
And then, so my parents were rightfully confused at why they had two other boys with no complications. And then I come along and just completely am not meeting milestones. After having a healthy birth, they didn't detect anything after that. And in 2006, I was admitted to the hospital four different times. I had two admissions in Vermont and two in Boston, Massachusetts. I had so many tests done. They covered the entire checklist. I had colonoscopies, x-rays, head MRIs, a CT scan of my abdomen, rectal motility testing, and many blood tests. Nothing came back. There was no positive test on any of those, anything indicative of what was causing these issues.
Wow.
Yeah, they tested for celiacs, Crohn's, colitis, cystic fibrosis. I had one of those sweat tests, all negative.
Oh, yeah. Your parents were probably frightened.
Yeah, because like I said, they had no experience with this. It's not like it was already seen in my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 2006. In 2007, it was more of the same, trying to figure out what was wrong. I continued to have low muscle tone, despite the fact that I was eating a lot. Like that was, my parents always make fun that I was like the ghost from Ghostbusters that just kept eating and eating. I would always have, every single picture of me as a child, I had like a bag of cereal just in my hands because I just loved to snack. And so it just didn't make sense that I wasn't gaining this weight. And because of this and the low muscle tone, the doctors actually started to suspect a form of mitochondrial disorder, but they weren't sure what kind. It was around this time that I also started to develop sugar issues. So it was just another issue regulating blood sugar. I would have highs in the 200s and almost 300s for no reason. And in 2007 as well, they placed my first gastrostomy tube, which I call it a G-tube now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still in the same spot that I still have it now, in the same spot that I got it placed in 2007.
Wow. So you were three.
Yeah.
When you got your G-tube.
The goal or the mindset with that was it would help relieve the pressure. If they, if that pressure was coming from my stomach, the G-tube would release the gas and hopefully relieve that. But in still looking for the mitochondrial disorder in 2008, January, right off the bat, I went to Atlanta in Georgia to have a muscle biopsy. They took a fresh muscle biopsy off my thigh. And I have a pretty big scar on my thigh from that.
Wow. You know?
And they took it and it did test positive for mitochondrial disorder. It's more specifically, it's complex 1 and 3, which I'm not too well versed in the science of that, but I think the complexes are, it's the products that the mitochondria use to create energy. So 1 and 3 refer to the different ones, the different products that are lacking. So it's creating less energy because it doesn't have those products.
Okay.
So 1 and 3 deficiencies, they cause similar symptoms as to what I had and what I experienced, like the muscle tone weakness, short stature, because I was extremely short for my age. Like, you look at old pictures, me in like 5th grade or even 4th grade, and I was like a whole foot and a half shorter than all of my friends.
Wow.
And yeah, in the extreme tiredness, I was a very inactive kid. Like, you think of kids and you think of running all over, running on the walls. Like, that was not me. I just like to sit, relax. So now that we have that diagnosis, it was a revelation for my parents, because now we finally figured out what was causing this, which in point should make the treatment easier. It should make, because you know what to treat, you have these proven treatments for this. So the next few years was all just figuring out what would make my life the easiest with my symptoms, treating the symptoms, because it's pretty well known that there's no cure for mitochondrial disorder. So it's more of just treating the symptoms, making your life easier, getting you all the tools that you need to live the fullest life that you could. And eventually I had a ileostomy placed, and that was, I believe that was around 2009 or 2010. And I still have that ileostomy now. So I've had that for around 15, 16 years. And that was, again, to try to help the distension and bloating. And then I was still not growing at all, really. I was below the growth chart on every single factor. They like to say, because I was always below the growth chart, but I followed my own. So my line was like 2 steps below, but it followed the same exact curve as the usual one, or the correct one. So I was growing in rate of myself. Like, I was going to my own rhythm, basically. They didn't, obviously that's not good. I shouldn't be below the line on the growth chart.
Right.
So I was at around 2012, I had a feeding tube placed in it's a jejunostomy. It's in the colon, or the small intestine, I think, small intestine. And that was to make sure that I was receiving enough nutrition to grow.
Okay.
And yeah, so I still have the G-tube now. I still have the J-tube. I still have the ostomy. I still get the feeds. Most of my nutrition is from the feeds. It's kind of like a don't rock the boat situation. We could experiment to see if I still really need all these things, this maintenance that I have.
Uh-huh.
But we don't, if I'm in a good place now, we don't want to take me off of it and experiment in case something else goes bad.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have the temptation to want to try, or are you more of a conservative guy that wants to follow what the doctors are saying?
I mean, I think it's interesting that I do not care about all of my amenities, my ostomy, my G-tube. I do not care because it happened when I was like 5 and 9 and 10. I don't really remember that much before I had any of these. So this is like my normal.
Mm-hmm.
So like I could not physically like imagine a life without my ostomy.
Uh-huh.
So that makes it a lot easier for me to cope with it and be comfortable with that. But I would always like to not have it if that meant I could be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's more maintenance. But we've had many conversations with my doctors about my ostomy reversing. It would kind of be cosmetic only. They said it'll be fine for your entire life. It won't ever need to be fixed. It won't ever need to be like replaced. There was really no issues that could arise from keeping it.
Wow.
It's a personal choice if you do not want this. But the alternative is kind of more tedious than my life now. And I don't really want to change that.
Yeah. And the repercussions of getting rid of it, you probably don't even know what all of that looks like.
Yeah, it would be a big surgery
because mm-hmm.
they have to put the intestine back into the stomach.
Oh, gosh.
And it would mean, obviously, because I do not go to the bathroom at all because of the ostomy. So it would mean that everything, and I'm on a liquid diet.
Uh-huh.
So it would mean that everything that comes out of the ostomy would come out the other end. So that would be, and they said I would have to be going to the bathroom like 10 times a day. I'm like, that's just not what I want when I can
right.
just empty my bag 5 times a day.
Yeah.
Not have to, like, I would not be able to go on a road trip that's more than like 2 hours long. It's just more convenient for where I'm at now
yeah.
in my life to keep this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have a great attitude in terms of, you know, not letting it bring you down and recognizing like this is just how life has been for you, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm sure it's very tough. I'm giving you complete credit for going through a lot and, you know, your parents too. I mean, really trying to figure this out. I'm sure it was so challenging.
Yeah.
So you've had your colon removed.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. how did that decision get made?
Yeah, I'd like to preface this, that the moment of taking my colon out and this whole experience was, and it still has been, like the scariest moment in my life and my parents and everybody that knew me. That this
okay.
was like the scariest moment. So
the lowest point of this journey.
The lowest point.
Yes.
Possible. So it started in 2015. I was still seeing doctors in Boston, Massachusetts. I had a pretty good care team there that was trying to figure out what exactly was, because they knew the mitochondrial disorder, but my digestive tract was basically paralyzed and motionless. So my GI team was really trying to figure out what to do with my digestive tract. Like, what was wrong with it? What can we do to get it back up and running? So I went in 2015, 7 a.m. in the morning. I had a motility study, which is when they're given food with a dye, radiologic dye in it. So they can, you eat it, they track it through your whole digestive system. So they can see at what point is it being blocked, if any, so they can visualize that.
Uh-huh.
So they put you under anesthesia to insert the probes. And at that point, they actually saw that my digestive system was fried. They saw that my colon was not very healthy at all. But they made the decision, and me and my parents think that they shouldn't have made this decision. They continued on with the test even after already seeing that my digestive system was fried. So I woke up after that procedure usually they give you some food to eat. I think it was like a turkey sandwich or something, which normally, since I don't eat, if I was given the opportunity to eat a turkey sandwich and they're just like, go ahead and eat it, I would eat it. Like nowadays, I would eat that. But at that moment, I was so groggy after coming off of anesthesia and I was not like myself. I felt very sick. My parents told the doctors, like, this is not normally what he looks like or what he acts like when he comes out from a procedure. So they did the test, short test, because I didn't eat very much. They concluded that my digestive system was just motionless, like something was blocking, no activity, nothing. So after the test, we went out to the car. It was just an outpatient test. Went to the car. I threw up in the car. I felt really nauseous. I threw up. We said, this was not normal for me. I never throw up. I never feel nauseous. So we went to the ER because we're like, oh, yeah, this procedure, he's not feeling good now. We should probably go to the ER. And a few hours later, after getting to the ER, I think it was only an hour and a half after I went to the ER, I went to the ICU.
Oh, gosh.
They took blood work and my electrolytes were all imbalanced. It was basically indicating I was septic. And yeah, so after the ICU, they knew that I was going to the ICU because of those levels. So it was a very fast going from the ER to the ICU. And then the next day, around in the afternoon, I went in for a procedure to have my colon completely removed. And the most insane thing about this is the day before, I was completely fine. We went to a pottery place in Boston. I was making pottery. I was painting it. And then
I love those places. They're so relaxing.
There's a really nice place in Boston that we used to go to every time. I just think that I went in the next day, 7 a.m. From that 7 a.m., about 30 hours later, I was in a medically induced coma after that procedure. And they took the colon out, but then I was just completely septic. Levels were all off. They put me in a medically induced coma. I was intubated for around 3 days. And the scariest thing of this is the doctors told my parents that I may not be the same mentally if I even make it out.
Oh my gosh. Like
they said I really didn't have much. They didn't think it was possible. I shouldn't say they didn't think it was possible, but the outlook in their terms was not very great for me to even come out of this and be able to do the things I was before. So it was just like a very scary thing for me to be intubated, unresponsive for these 3 days after coming to Boston for an outpatient procedure.
So there was never any intention of you getting the colon removed when you guys went
absolutely
to Boston?
Not. No.
Oh.
And yeah, I've had that motility study. This was either my third or fourth time doing that. So I was experienced with that. We knew what to expect, but apparently we didn't, because that it was like the biggest 90-degree turn,
right,
or 180 turn ever. And so they eventually coaxed me out of this medically induced coma. I was very groggy. My mom, I have a lot of videos. She would play me like YouTube videos. They said if you play something that he likes, shows or anything like that, it wakes him up more.
Okay.
So I used to watch a lot of video game YouTubers, and there's videos of like me really sleepy and groggy with like an iPad just playing these videos to try to get me to wake up.
Because you're like 11 at this time?
I was 10.
Okay.
My birthday is in November. This was October of 2015. The first thing that I said when I came out of that coma was, can I have a popsicle? Because I loved popsicles, and it was a few days without me eating anything, and I was like, I still have sleep, and my dad's like, well, you're going to have to wake up a little bit more to have a popsicle, because you are very groggy. So this was like a really good thing that I woke up and I was still me, but I still had an infection from the colon. They placed drainage tubes to drain all the infected fluid out. I don't know, the scar to get a colon removed is huge. And especially I was very small at 10 years old. It is a huge scar and I still have it. It is down right past like my, it's probably like 4 inches past my navel all the way down to like my groin. It's the entire like stomach area.
Wow. Scar.
And so I had the infection. They were dealing this off. They were fighting this infection. And even after I woke up, the doctors were still saying to my mom, and I should say that I learned a lot about this. My parents like to be transparent with me, like with my medical. I was very in charge of my medical decision, not my decisions, but yeah, I would say my decisions. I was involved with my medical care. I liked my autonomy. I liked to do my medicines, I liked to get my equipment ready. I was very involved in mm-hmm. that. Even when like I was, the nurses would come in and flush my IV, I liked to do that because sometimes they would do it so fast and it hurt. So I was just like, just let me do it. I know what I like. I know what
they're probably not used to that.
Yeah. And so they tell my parents that even after all this, I still might not make it out because of the infection. Like it was still a really bad infection. And I had those drains eventually. And then, because why not, I had another issue is that the scar was opening up. It was actually like coming undone. There was a little hole in the middle of the scar that just kept getting bigger and bigger. And because of the infection, it was getting infected. So they eventually had to put me back in surgery. And they place what's called a wound vac, where it's like a sponge that goes on a scar and sucks up everything. It's like a vacuum seal. It sucks up everything. So I had to carry around, along with my feeding bag, my IV, I had to carry around this like vacuum that was attached to my stomach. And I think they did the wound vac because you have to be placed under anesthesia to change it. I think they did that 4 times.
Oh my gosh.
So in addition to the colon.
It turned into such a spiral.
It was I think we figured out because I'll fast forward. I was released, I think November 14th. I was in the hospital for a month and I had 7 surgeries in that time. And I mean, only one of them was that big major. It was like I think it was a 4 or 5 hour surgery was the colon surgery. It was a long surgery. And because this was October, I spent Halloween in the birthday or in the, I was going to say my birthday. I spent Halloween in the hospital and my 11th birthday.
But those are, you're a kid. I mean, these milestones are huge, you know?
Yeah. But I think it's important to recognize how well the staff at this hospital is. It was Massachusetts General Hospital. They were like the most incredible team of nurses, patient care assistants, and child life specialists.
Uh-huh.
They had a Halloween party. You would go around to all the different like nurses' state. They had 2 floors. So they had. There was 1 floor that was like babies to toddlers
mm-hmm.
or like babies to like 10 years old. And I actually was supposed to be on that floor because of my age. But they said, I think he'd like the 10-year-old, 18-year-old floor a little bit better because it was more like teen and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. So they brought me up to that floor and they had Halloween. They had costumes. I dressed up as like Peter Pan or a pirate. Or something. I got pushed around my wheelchair. We went to different floors, different doors, and we trick-or-treated in that hospital, which is like something you never think would be possible, but these child life specialists really try to make it as fun as it can
be. That's amazing.
Yeah. And again, I spent my birthday in there and they had a party for me for my birthday. Aww. They had balloons. They had a cake. I couldn't eat the cake, but they had some treats that I could eat.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like a whole birthday party for me in the hospital, which is just like so special that you don't think about that often. That I think child life specialists don't get enough credit for how much they do to make the nurses and the doctors are there to make sure the patient stays alive and is healthy and is cared for in that sense. But these child life specialists, they have such a huge responsibility to make sure that the kid has fun and makes it as special as it could be to be in the hospital with life-threatening injuries or illness. So in addition to all that, I had so much support from my family and friends. We had local pubs and bars in Plattsburgh, where I live, that were running fundraising money. They would take portions of their profit to donate to me for like my hospital bills and stuff.
So
there was a lot of fundraisers in my name. There was, at my school, there was a thing where if you paid, I don't know, it was like $1 or $5, you could wear like a green thing because Mito Green.
Yeah.
You pay this money, all that money was to help me. And they took a picture of all my like classmates in green. And it was in the yearbook. I had an entire page in that school yearbook recognizing me and my fight and my journey. So that's like always memorialized in that. Yeah, in the yearbook.
That's so beautiful.
Is insane to me to look back at that now. Like everybody came together.
Yeah.
To support one of their community members that was going through the worst time in his life.
Oh my gosh.
And it was just so special.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Thank you for taking us through that. I'm sure it's not super easy to talk about.
Yeah.
What a tough time. So in your early years, I mean, you had gone through more than a lot of people go through medically in their entire lives.
Yep.
Were you going to school? I mean, obviously not when you were in the hospital for the month or maybe right after that either, but overall, like, did you go to school in a traditional way?
Yeah, for the most part, like you said, in that month, my school was so flexible that they basically just exempt everything.
Wow.
Like, they said, don't focus on school. We do not need you doing middle school history assignments while you're fighting for your life. They just exempt it. They didn't grade me, but they didn't put a zero in for anything.
Okay.
But before that, I did go to school in a traditional way. My parents placed a lot of importance on having me have a school experience as normal as possible. Because they knew my limitations, they knew what my life could be, so they wanted to make sure that I was having a normal school experience. Mm-hmm. So I'll just take you through basically all my school. So preschool, when I was younger, like I said earlier, I didn't have as much equipment and stuff as possible. So preschool was pretty normal. I still tired easily, but my mom was actually my teacher in preschool.
Oh, really?
So that made it a lot easier because I had someone there that knew me.
And it probably felt good for her because, you know, she had the peace of mind of being there with you and having eyes on
somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I had in elementary school, I had an IEP, which gave me a lot of accommodations to ensure that I was able to complete school with my issues. So I had a one-on-one aide for my entire school journey. I was going to say they, but it's always been a she. That's kind of interesting to me. My aide would always be with me at all times. She would helped me with anything that I needed. And part of it was because I couldn't eat food, I would like to take food.
There was that innate
yeah. feeling like if I can't eat food, but I'm still a kid and I want to eat this food that looks good yeah. and smells good.
Yeah.
And so part of the aid, and I think a lot of the people that just knew me, like even my friends knew that I couldn't eat it. So even they were watching me at some point. But so I had the one-on-one aid. In elementary school, I actually had nap times.
Oh,
because
wow.
of my energy. I think it was in elementary school, it's in the gym teacher's office. I had an actual like cot set up that I could, like a portable cot set up that I could just, I would nap for like 30 minutes of the day.
Huh.
Because like normally nap time goes away with like first grade of kindergarten.
Yeah.
But I still needed it.
You needed it. Yeah.
So I took that. And I did get some occupational and physical therapy throughout to try to strengthen my muscles and coordination and stuff like that. I like to talk about how different gym class was because obviously I used a wheelchair for a lot of movement. I didn't do gym class normal, but my school system was like so accommodating towards that. I had like an adapted gym program, basically.
Wow.
I would go in with the normal gym class.
Okay.
But I would all, because in gym class in elementary, it's like you play games
mm-hmm.
that are physical exercises. So it's not really like running laps or playing basketball. It's like fun games. They were always adapted towards me. Like we would play hit the bowling pin with like you'd throw balls at bowling pins and you would knock them down. I had one pin or one or two pins that only I could hit. So nobody could go and steal my pins. So I had an opportunity because these kids would be running back and forth, hitting every single one. And another game was kickball. You're supposed to kick the ball and you throw it at the person running to get them out. They had to run up with the ball and tap me with the ball instead of throwing it because I was like so small
yeah.
and if I got hit with it I would have been knocked over.
Right.
So
you know, it's incredible how, my guess is all of these, you know, the child life specialists and the accommodations at school and your parents' support, I mean it created your childhood, you know, and
yeah.
you've had setbacks, but you've had a lot of support. And I know you've already said that, but I think it really rings true that you have so much positivity to share with us about your childhood. And I give a lot of people credit for, you know, really lifting you up in the ways you needed it, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's like, I hear all these stories and you think of like old movies and stuff where the person with the disability gets bullied a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens a lot in real life. And I just...
I'm pushed aside.
And I'm just like incredibly fortunate that I absolutely have never experienced anything like that. And I think that's something that I'm so lucky to have because I know that is not the experience. I know that is not every single person's experience.
And I think it's so beautiful that you do appreciate it. There are people that have a lot more than you that don't appreciate anything. So, you know, you also see life with a different lens. I always say that about myself with mitochondrial disease, that, you know, life just is different
mm-hmm.
for you, for me, for all of our community. But it's lovely that you can acknowledge what these people have like stamped on your heart, you know, it stamped
yeah.
as in a positive, you know.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that I'm not happy that you've gone through so much, but that
mm-hmm.
you have been able to even thread all this beauty within your story, even just as we've been talking, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I really wanted
I wanted
to say that and wanted you to know I saw that.
Yeah. And even like even more things that my school did that just were like can be unheard of in some other places. I used a wheelchair for going between classes. Like I could walk I could walk inside the classroom, but the long hallways, yeah. I just could not do that.
And probably with the crowd, so, you know, with the other
yeah,
kids.
Between, yeah, so actually in high school, I would be allowed to leave like 2 minutes early.
Good. So I, that makes sense.
So I could miss the crowd.
Yeah.
And, but I had a wheelchair in elementary school, and then I switched to a fully power chair. That's like a big, hefty chair, really heavy. And you know the buses with the wheelchair lifts?
Yeah.
That you, because this was a chair that I owned. So I would get picked up in that and they'd bring me to school. But they were actually renting it from another district. And it was really expensive to rent that specific lift. So instead of renting it, they bought me an entire new wheelchair, powered chair, like the same one I had at home, to keep at school and use at school.
Wow.
So this chair, it went with me from elementary school, like fourth grade, all the way to senior year.
Wow.
And they would pay for like repairs or anything that needed. It wasn't my chair.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have it now. It's still at the school. I always wonder who's using it now.
Yeah.
I hope it's being used, put to good use, not just in a closet. But it's just one of those things that like a school district buys me a new chair to use at school. Like that's insane to think about that. And especially like we're in a pretty rural area in New York, like kind of like the North Country. Like you wouldn't think that this type of area would be so accommodating. It's just insane to me. And it's something I'm always grateful
for. And obviously, it's, you know, it's not like your family knew of another case where they were so accommodating for someone else. And that's why they, you know, went there.
Yeah.
It just happened to be, you know, people can really make a difference in others' life experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
You don't eat at all, right?
No.
Take us through all of that.
So I do eat. Very little.
Okay.
It's like I said, when I was younger, I would eat way more solid food But as I got the G tube, which was the drainage tube and the feeding tube, I really technically didn't need to eat because all of the nutrition that I was getting was from that tube.
Mm-hmm.
So, but obviously, I still had the ability to eat. Like, there wasn't anything wrong with my mouth or anything like that. So, naturally, I would want to eat. You smell these smells, good smelling food. You taste it once, and then you're like, wow, that tastes really good. I want to keep eating that. So, anything that I eat by mouth then and now is purely for comfort.
Okay.
For getting the taste. And I've actually been slowly increasing what I've been able to eat. It used to just be, I used to just have a diet of popsicles, candy, Jell-O. Like it was really limited for a long time, but my parents really they kept trying to find things I was able to eat that tasted good and weren't just like bland stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So still now, it's mostly a liquid diet, but I have increased. Recently I started eating pudding.
Okay.
I make like instant sugar-free pudding. I like that. I eat baby food squash.
Okay.
I mean, there's a stigma around baby food, but it's just squash.
Right. If you look at the ingredients, just water and the food itself.
It's just a thinner version of squash, which is good for me. So I eat that. I eat Jell-O. Still eat popsicles. Recently, I've started eating. It's kind of gross, but I eat fruit, but I can't actually swallow it. So I only do it at home because it's gross to do it when I'm out, but I chew it up and spit it out.
Uh-huh.
So I'm getting the juice, I'm getting all that, but I'm not swallowing any of the chunks.
Uh-huh.
So like grapes, apples, clementines, cantaloupe, all stuff like that. So we're trying to figure out, that's one of my bigger goals. And I also have increased limitations because I'm allergic to eggs and nuts, which takes down
a
a big group.
So that's a complete aside, correct?
I believe so. I don't think that's tied to anything. And one thing that is tied to the mitochondrial is I have like a fatty acid disorder.
Okay.
Where I have a really hard time absorbing fats.
Uh-huh.
So anything with oil, I just cannot tolerate, and it sends my levels, my blood levels out of whack. So with the nuts, the eggs, the oil, it really cuts down on a lot of things that I could be eating. So,
wow.
Yeah, we try right now. I recently got a new geneticist doctor, and she's been trying to coordinate care with like GI doctors, mm-hmm. nutritionists, trying to figure out how, because I should say that I'm in a very stable spot right now, and we don't want to change anything too bad. But if at any point in my history that we could start to change stuff, it would be now.
Yeah,
because I'm so stable.
Yeah, you're young.
I'm keeping up my weight. I'm somewhat taller than I used to be. So it's, if any time, it would probably be now to start experimenting and trying to find different things that work for me and finding things that don't.
Yeah. So is family dinner a tough time for you?
Yeah. I never would go to, I would never sit with my family at dinner.
Okay.
Because I would never have the same meal as them.
Right.
I would always have, like I said, a Jell-O. I would usually just, when I was younger, I would have very scheduled times for my meals because eating was like this thing that I didn't get to do much. I was very scheduled, like 12 o'clock was my lunch, 3 o'clock snack, 5 o'clock dinner. Like that was, so at 5 o'clock, I would get a popsicle and go and sit in the living room. And my family would be eating like spaghetti or something. So it is isolating in that sense that I'm not there with them. But I would sit, because we have an island pretty close to the table. So I would sit at the island and talk with them sometimes. But I mean, it's not like I never talked to my family. So that missing out on dinner wasn't always like, oh, I feel very isolated uh-huh. from my family. It's just that specific moment. And I do think it ties into other, because I don't think you don't think about every day how important of a socializer that food is.
Oh, yeah.
It, like, when you think about it, every party that you go to has food. Every
right.
social event has food. And my family never really went out to dinner. Like, there's a lot of families that go out to dinner like 3 times a week. I don't know for sure if that was because of me.
Yeah.
Or if it just was something they didn't like to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very kind of, I think for lack of better words, embarrassing when you go to Olive Garden and they go through each person. They're like, oh, what would you have? What would you have? And they get to me and I say nothing.
Yeah.
Because then they're like, well, why are you here?
Right.
If you don't want anything, yeah. why are you
Do you here? Not like our menu?
And actual funny story, I don't know if you've ever heard of Dick's Last Resort.
Oh, yeah.
Diner.
We used to have one of those. Uh-huh.
Yeah, where they write the like kind of obscene stuff
yeah,
on your
Yeah, they're
hats.
Obnoxious with their they're customers.
They're mean to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my hat, because they asked me what I could eat, and my parents said, oh, he's not eating anything. My hat said, my parents don't feed me. And it was, I mean, obviously it was a joke, but I thought it was really funny that they interpreted that. But that's like more of a fearful, like when you tell somebody that, like, is that what people are thinking? Like realistically? That,
yeah.
Because I know that does happen with some kids. Some parents don't feed their kids. Like sometimes
Or were you like misbehaving before lunch
yeah.
and you
yeah,
got
like
lunch
you're not getting anything.
I mean, parents can, you know, who knows what the story with that family would be, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, it probably affected my parents too in some
yeah.
small ways.
Yeah.
Like, what are people thinking?
And I'm sure they had, you know, a lot of empathy for you not being able to eat while they were.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything that I could have, even if it was like the slight, I was so like easily pleased. Like I would get a sugar packet and I'd be fine.
Oh.
Like a ketchup packet, something, anything that I could eat. And my mom always brought lollipops and candy.
Yeah.
So I would have something to eat. But
wow.
It's always like I could never go to friends' parties unless someone came with me. And that in itself is kind of embarrassing. So I kind of just steered clear from anything like that.
Huh.
So it definitely is isolating, but it's something that I've had to get used to. And I don't really see the point in, I mean, there's sometimes when you think like, oh, what could your life have been if I was more social with my friends and going out to these events? But it's not going to change anything now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really see the point in looking back on that and looking down on myself for not going to these things if it's not going to change anything.
Yeah. It's a really good attitude. You can't do anything about it. You told me in the past that you had a big growth spurt in 2020. Can you walk us through that and how it impacted your condition?
Yeah, so I think the growth spurt is something that isn't really, it hasn't been scientifically proven
right.
by any doctor that this was the reason. It's more of just a theory that myself and my parents have put together. But when COVID hit in early 2020,
right.
Our school shut down. I was in the, towards the end of my, I would say the middle of my 10th grade year, and school shut down. Everybody went home. And it was around this time, so 2020. So I was like 15 at this point, turning 16 in that year. And I went through late puberty because of my mitochondrial disorder. It kind of just delayed everything physically. And being at home, not exerting myself at school, my mom really thinks that that is what caused my body time to really sit down and like cook and like really take its time. And I wasn't exerting all this energy that I already had a lack of because of the mitochondrial disorder, that it really just allowed me time to grow and stuff. Because by the end of 2020, I was really short at the beginning of the year. I was probably like 4'10 or something, of like under 5 foot. And then by the end, I was like 5'4, 5'5.
Oh my gosh.
I should say I'm not for sure if it happened all in that year, but I'm 5'6 and a half now. So something happened where I wasn't growing as much before and then I grew.
Yeah.
And it could have just been late puberty.
Uh-huh.
Because
and a pure coincidence.
Yeah, and I
or your
I
body
stayed,
just needed a rest and a reset.
That's what exactly what my mom is thinking.
Yeah.
And I stayed in, so school went back in 11th grade in 2021.
Yeah.
But they still had the option to stay home if you wanted. So I was like, well, cuz part of my illness is like a little bit of a weakened immune system.
For sure, for sure.
And with the whole COVID thing,
yeah.
It was very scary. So we just played it safe. If I could do all my stuff from home, there's really no point to risk it and go to school, because they were having outbreaks. Like every few weeks, the school was getting closed for 4 days, or because if somebody tested positive, they had to close the school down. So it was like, why should we risk that?
Yeah, if you could
just
go
do everything from home.
Yeah.
So I stayed home the entire 11th grade, so half of 10th, entire 11th, and I went back to school senior year. And I was like a completely different person from when I first went, when I first left. But ever since then, I mean, like I said earlier, the 2015 was definitely the low point. I had some rocky moments between 2015 and 2020, little scares, not anything too serious. But since 2020, I've been on the up. I haven't had any hospital stays, and it's all been increasingly better since then. So it's like, it's partially like when like a bad thing causes a good thing, in a sense.
Yeah. I know for me, just with my chronic back pain and how I can't stand and I can't socialize, I really didn't have any issue Zooming with my friends in the evening, you know, and being home and being able to sit most of the day. And I didn't have any back flare-ups when we were in, you know, really locked down. It's interesting how things affect you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you've really just carried such a positive attitude throughout everything we've discussed, and you've gone through a lot. I give you so much credit.
Thank you.
So let's talk about this organization, Living the Dream. It seems like it's really provided you some unique, well-deserved experiences. Can you share some of what you've done with them, how you found them? I'd love for others in the community to possibly take advantage of it too.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would be surprised with how many support organizations there are. Just like I said with the Child Life Experts, there's a lot of people out there that want to make kids with disabilities, life-threatening illnesses, they want to make their life better. So I got involved. I think my parents found it because they were trying to research these different things with an organization called Living the Dream. And what they actually do is they fundraise, they call them Dream Days, where they offer people with life-threatening illnesses their dream day where they can meet and greet with their heroes. So pretty sure it's exclusive to concerts, but they do VIP access to concerts, special events, stuff like that. So for me, I went to something called Warped Tour.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like a rock festival. And I mean, I was a little, this was before 2015. I was like a little kid. I was not too into rock. Like it wasn't like I chose this specific artist and stuff, but it was the experience of going to this festival.
Yeah.
And I went behind the scenes and I met all these bands that were performing. I was on stage, like right on the side while they were performing.
That's so cool.
It was really cool. I did that twice. And one of the times, this band brought me out on stage and they had everybody scream my name.
Oh my god.
Everybody in the audience. And it's like Coachella level audiences. Like it was full. And they screamed my superhero persona that I had as a kid, Mighty Matthew. they were like, 1, 2, 3, Mighty Matthew. They had the entire audience scream my name. And I wasn't like super into it. Like I was very like stage fright up there because they had this entire audience screaming my name. And it was just like something that like that band went out of the, like I said, or like you said, with how many other people support you along your journey, this band that just like heard of me from their representative or something and met me 2 minutes before they went on stage decided to do that, like in the blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
Decided to let me go on stage.
And it created such a beautiful moment for you that you still remember.
Yeah. And so I did that. And there's so many other organizations. I can name a few. There's similar to Living the Dream. There's an organization called Do It for the Love. And like that, it focuses on music and concerts. So I was actually able to see Imagine Dragons in concert.
Oh, that's
covered,
awesome.
Covered by them. And a meet and greet. Pretty short meet and greet, but I got to talk with them for a minute and take a picture.
Oh, that's so cool. My son loved them for years. Please tell me they're nice people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember it that clearly, but I mean, it's a meet and greet. It was a quick, hi, how are you? They were nice. They weren't like shoving me aside and be like, okay, we gotta take this picture. They were enthusiastic. So that was, and it was a good concert.
Yeah. They put on a great performance. My son has gone with my husband. That's so wonderful.
Yeah, and there's just so many, like I would encourage anybody to, I think that these websites, if they search them up, would have way more accurate information than what I can portray. But there's just so many. Like there's Make-A-Wish, there's there's actually one similar to Make-A-Wish called Brave Young Hearts. They focus on outdoor adventures. So they're like Make-A-Wish where they give you a wish, but it's all outdoors.
Oh,
so
cool.
I got an all-covered trip to go to Colorado and visit a wildlife sanctuary, which is like kind of better than a zoo.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just like miles in acres and acres of huge enclosures. Like, it's not a zoo.
Right.
Enclosure.
It doesn't
it's
feel like
huge...
an exhibit. It feels like they're
like
home.
Yeah, and there's only like two animals per huge thing. So it really just feels like it's not for the show of these animals. It's just giving them, and I think a lot of them are endangered. So it's more of like an accurate rehabilitation and conservation thing. And I also went to an aquarium in Colorado. So that was like, it was an insane thing to do. And so there's that one. Make-A-Wish, obviously, I think a lot of people know about Make-A-Wish. I went to Disneyland from my Make-A-Wish when I was four.
Oh, wow.
There's a few others. One called Brave Gowns is an organization that offers unique and comfy hospital gowns to kids. And
oh, that's so special.
They sent me a few. They have so many unique designs. And they even had an opportunity that I designed a gown and they made it into an actual gown that you can buy.
Really?
So it's a unique experience and organization.
Yeah.
These kids would rather have a gown with a superhero.
Yeah,
or,
colorful.
I think they even I just looked recently, they had like a Blippi gown. So it's much better than just having like the standard hospital ones that they give you.
Uh-huh.
Because like, even a little thing like that can make or break a child's experience in the hospital. Yeah, and another one is, there's two that focus with superheroes. There's one called Superhero Project.
Oh, we've had them on the podcast.
Oh my, yeah. They are amazing. Like, because I've had two posters done by them.
Is that where Mighty Matthew came from?
No. Mighty Matthew was way before that.
Okay, who thought of Mighty Matthew?
That was me.
You thought of it.
That was because I was still pretty young. I think I was like 7 or 8 when that came about. Maybe even younger, but I was fascinated with superheroes, obviously. And I wanted to kind of be, I think it started as me just wanting to be a superhero, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So I created my persona. I said I was a superhero that would steal energy from bad guys that didn't need it, like take their energy and give it to the kids and the people that needed the energy.
Oh my gosh, I wish that were true. I wish we could do that.
Yeah, so what started off as me just being a superhero for myself really turned into kind of a motivational figure. Like I would, every year I'd put the costume back. We had a costume made by another organization and I had costume made with my logo on it. I had a mask, cape, everything. And it was kind of just like a motivational figure to kind of uplift some kids and anyone who needed to see that somebody with a disability can be a superhero. And I think that was lacking at the time that I created that. So the Superhero Project, they did two posters for me and they do events.
Yeah.
They do live drawings with like people from Pixar and Disney and like all these animation studios. And
they have a great team of artists and they meet with each family individually. I loved learning about what they do.
Yeah, they ask all these questions and they really design one that you want to see. Like they don't just get your name and draw whatever. They really want to create what you're envisioning.
Yeah.
Yeah. And before, I only got involved with them a few years ago, but before that, there was an organization called Tiny Superheroes.
Oh.
Where they were probably one of the first organizations that I was a part of. They create little trading cards for your superhero persona. So they kind of were similar to me where they said like Mighty Matthew, they would have whatever your name was, they would put like something in front of it. Like if your name was Sasha or something, they'd put strong Sasha.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd make these cards with your picture on it and have your story on the back. And I was with them, and they do missions every month that are supposed to have like a theme to it, like a hope mission or a creativity mission, and you get patches because they have these kids create missions and they send them out to other kids, and you get a patch if you do the challenge.
Oh, that's
or the mission.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I hope that the listeners today or whenever you're listening really do take advantage. You know, if there's a kid in your life that it's affected by Mito, I mean, with the internet, all this information becomes so in front of your face that you could create this type of experience for your own kid, you know?
Yeah. And obviously, like the other one, like Mito Action, and I've been a part of the Muscular Dystrophy Association for a long time because mitochondrial disease is in the umbrella of muscular dystrophy. So I've been a part of that. They used to do parties, Christmas parties every year. They would do the muscle walk, like a fundraising walk, similar to the Mito mm-hmm. walk. And they had a lot. I'm actually still involved. They do a mentorship program online.
Oh.
It's a month long. It's a STEM. So it's science, technology, yeah. engineering, math. They do a mentorship program. I think it's for like 16 to 21. So actually, it's starting in February, and this is my last year doing it. So they have these mentors in different fields like medicine, engineering, technology, coding, like all this stuff. And they do a month-long session where they mentor these kids 16 to 21 with disabilities to expose them to the possible fields that they could go into.
Wow.
So it's really just like an exploration. And it's more of like, since it's older kids, it's more of like a, it's more mature in career. They talk to you about college and all these sciences. And I've been doing it. I already chose my path, I think, when I started doing it. But I still, even though I've chose my path, I'm already working I'm not seeking advice on how to go through college, but it's still just like a nice thing to get together with other people in the same field as me
mm-hmm.
and explore that. And they actually just asked me to do an introductory speech on the first meeting to talk about my experiences.
Good for you.
With things. And then I'm like, yep, I'll do it. I don't know what I'll say, but I'll say hopefully something
inspirational. You will be wonderful. And what is that program called?
It's the MDA, Muscular Dystrophy Association Mentorship Program, as I think what they call it.
Well, you've given our listeners a lot of great information. Your very inspiring story. Thank you so much for being on the show, Matthew. I have really enjoyed getting to know you. I am so rooting for you to just stay stable and mm-hmm. to stay in this spot and to just continue bringing such light to those around you. I'm so impressed by you.
Yeah, I just think it's my responsibility as somebody who has gone through this and is able to tell the story, because I've had a lot of friends that have not made it past 10, 15, 20 because of similar illnesses. I think it's my responsibility to share my experiences and any advice or inspiration that I can offer to somebody going through this.
Well, you do a really good job.
I appreciate that.
I have loved sharing your story with our community. Thank you so much. I hope to have you on again. I would love to. Well, thank you so much, Matthew, and we'll definitely hear from you again soon.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.